The three central foods of the Seder, succinctly summarized in the Haggadah, are Pesach, Matzah, Umaror. And yet, a whole host of misconceptions surround these three seemingly simple words. Too many to list here, but I will throw out some of the central misconceptions before we get down to business.
The Tikva Fund is proud to present the Haggadah, a political classic, a series of 8 audio recordings that together make up a full course on the most beloved and most popular work of Jewish liturgy. Our teacher is Rabbi Dr. Meir Soloveitchik of Congregation Sherith Israel, the oldest Jewish congregation in the United States. Rabbi Soloveitchik is also the director of the Zahava and Moshe L. Strauss Center for Torah and Western Thought at Yeshiva University. In these lectures, you'll hear Rabbi Soloveitchik explore the text of the Haggadah as a source of political and moral wisdom, bringing out its deeper arguments about family, memory, and the human condition, about politics and freedom, about history and sacrifice. This episode is the Politics of the Paschal Lamb.
The first is the actual translation of the word Pesach, which most people take to mean Passover. According to the theory that most people put forward, what happened in Egypt was as follows. God is journeying throughout Egypt, striking down the firstborn. He wishes to know where the Israelite houses are. And so he tells the Israelites to spread the blood of the lamb on the outer doorposts of their homes. This will show which homes are Jewish or Israelite, providing a sort of sacrificial GPS for God, and therefore he is able to be poseach, to pass over those homes and strike only the Egyptian homes. It's a fine theory, as long as you overlook the simple point that it makes no sense at all. After all, God has already struck Egypt with 9 earlier plagues and has had no problem distinguishing between which homes are Israelite and which are Egyptian. He does not need blood on a door to show him which houses to strike and which to actually pass over. Moreover, according to much of traditional rabbinic commentary, the blood of the home was placed not on the outer doorpost, but actually inside the home itself. Thus, actually, what is occurring, and one can devote an entire lecture to this alone, is the following. Blood is utilized in biblical Judaism for purification rituals. A mitzorah, one translated as a leper, is purified in a ritual in which the blood of the sacrifice is sprinkled upon him. One who is impure from coming in contact with death is purified through the taking of a red heifer, who is so seemingly bloody that its entire body is red. It is then burnt, and the ashes, which are, as it were, saturated with its blood, are sprinkled in order to purify one who has become tamei, one who has become impure. In the Haftarah for last week's Parashat HaChodesh, which describes the Passover ritual, the Haftarah says, in order to purify the temple, take blood of a sacrifice and spread it on the doorpost of the temple, v'chiteta et hamikdash, and you shall purify the temple. And so what is actually occurring is as follows. As God says in Exodus, for the 10th plague, I will unleash a mashchit, a destroyer. You, however, will put blood on your door that will purify your homes in the midst of pagan Egypt so that I can dwell in that home and shield you. As he says, velo etein la mashchit, I will not let the destroyer enter the home. The actual video footage that we have of this moment from the 10 Commandments is actually pretty accurate. The green thing is going around, killing people, and God is actually not allowing the destroyer, the plague that he has personally unleashed, from entering Israelite homes. The blood is applied inside so that God can actually dwell inside. The sacrifice is eaten inside because what is occurring is that in the midst of Egypt, right before the Exodus, every Israelite dwelling place becomes a temple in miniature, a mikdash ma'at, in which God has his abode. Thus, the word Pesach does not actually mean Passover. Elijah on Mount Carmel, in his duel with the prophets of Baal, on Mount Carmel, where the prophets of Baal used to serve their pagan god known as Baal. That location was the first biblical Baal park. Okay? It's a tough crowd, okay? He says to the people of Israel, Ad matai atem poschim al shtei asifim, which means, how long will you hover indeterminately over two possibilities, God or Baal? And then we're told later that the prophets of Baal were poseach over their sacrifice, which surely does not mean they jumped over their sacrifice, but rather they hovered over their sacrifice, praying. Thus, through the Paschal Lamb, God dwells amongst us all, turning our homes in Egypt into temples. That is why when the Paschal Lamb is brought in Jerusalem in commemoration of this moment, there is no ritual to recreate the spreading of the blood. You don't need to turn your homes into a temple because you are at the temple. But in Egypt, God is poseach and thereby shielding. Or as I often say, Pesach should not be translated as Passover. It is rightly better translated as hangover, which is a pretty accurate description and also the result of the Pesach Seder. So that is what Pesach means. So that's one misconception. Another common misconception that we must keep in mind, and here I'm going to be a courageous truth teller, the charoset is not one of the central foods of the Seder. It is not even one of the foods of the Seder. It is a prop. It is meant to remind us of something, but is not meant to be eaten. The maror is dipped into the charoset, but then according to Jewish law, you're supposed to shake it off so its taste does not impact the taste of the bitter herbs. The lettuce that is the bitter herb is not meant to be the lettuce boat for the charoset. That is not what is meant to take place here. If you wish to eat the charoset during the meal, knock yourself out. But it is not one of the foods of the Seder. That is important for us to understand. And that leads us to our most primary misconception, which is what is taking place culinarily in the interaction between the Paschal Lamb and the garnish that is meant to come with it, which is, of course, the bitter herb. And understanding this rightly from a culinary perspective actually will shed profound light on what I call the politics of the Paschal Lamb, because it teaches us, rightly understood, a great deal about what it means to be free. And therefore, even though today we do not have the Paschal Lamb at our Seder, for us as American Jews enjoying more freedom than any diaspora Jewish community ever enjoyed, as you will see, the politics of the Paschal Lamb speaks profoundly to all of us. In order to see how this is so, let us turn now to the text of the Haggadah. We are introduced at the conclusion of the Magid portion to the explanation of these three central foods. Rabban Gamliel haya omer kosh lo amar shlosha dvaril ba-pesach lo yatsa yedei chovato. All those who do not explain these three foods does not fulfill his obligation. According to most opinions, this means you do not fulfill your obligation to tell the story of the Exodus if you do not describe these foods. But according to Nachmanides, fascinatingly, what Rabban Gamliel means in the Haggadah is that if you do not explain these foods, you do not fulfill the obligation of eating the foods, even if you eat them. Meaning that you're supposed to meld in this mitzvah taste and explanation. Ingestion and description are meant to go hand in hand in the eating of the Pesach, the Matzah, and the Maror. And so then we explain it in that order. Pesach, why do we eat the Paschal Lamb? Because God was poseach, because he hovered over us and shielded us from the final plague right before we were released. Matzah, why? Because, as I mentioned before, we journeyed out of Egypt. Maror, why? Because before all this happened, before the final plague, before the Pesach, before the Matzah, before the rush out of Egypt, we suffered bitterly as slaves. That is the text. Pesach, then Matzah, then Maror. And the question, when you stop and think about it, is obvious. If the Paschal Lamb reflects the beginning of freedom, and Matzah the actual exit from Egypt, and the Maror is meant to allow us to experience the bitterness of slavery that took place before these events ever occurred, then why in the world would you say it in this order? It's an obvious and simple question when you think about it. If the foods tell the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim, should we not tell the story of these foods in paragraphs that are ordered, Maror, Pesach, Matzah? Everybody see that question? Obvious question. There was an episode of MASH, remember the show MASH, where there was some bomb that needed to be defused. So they sent somebody, everybody else stood miles away, and they sent one guy to defuse it, and they were reading instructions on the over the radio. And they said, first you need a wrench. Now rotate the locking ring counterclockwise. Now remove the tail assembly. And then carefully cut the wires leading to the clockwork fuse. But first, remove the fuse. Okay? Okay. Boom. Okay? Now, it's out of order. So, why here too, Pesach, Matzah, and then Maror. Maror, only if you've, the bitterness of slavery, only if you've described the food of freedom? Very strange. And the truth is actually, when you ponder the rabbinic theology and law behind these passages, the experiential aspect of this and the textual order is stranger still. Because according to Jewish law, there is actually no biblical obligation to eat bitter herbs today. There is only an obligation to eat bitter herbs when you have the Paschal lamb. Those two are intertwined. When it comes to matzah, we have an independent obligation based on the verse, Ba'erev tochlu matzot. On the night of Pesach, you eat matzah. That, as rabbinic law takes it, tells us that you have to eat matzah whether or not you have the Paschal lamb. But biblically, there is no obligation to eat maror. We eat it only as a remembrance of the mikdash of the temple. But without the Passover lamb, without this symbol of the beginning of freedom, there is no real obligation to eat maror. And again, the question is, why not? If the whole idea of maror is to ingest physically bitterness, to experience bitterness, and thereby remember and remind ourselves of the bitterness of slavery, why would you not want to do this on the eve of the Exodus and of our commemoration, whether or not we have the Paschal lamb? So this hints to us that we have to understand the intertwining of the Paschal lamb and the maror, why they are meant to be eaten together, and why the foods are listed in this order. So in order to answer all these questions, we have to focus on what, as Dr. Silver mentioned before, is for Judaism the true focus of our faith, and that is food. As we mentioned before, quoting the food writer John McQuaid, the ancient Greeks considered taste to be the lowest and grossest form of the senses, and vision the highest. Vision could discern the subtleties of high art, but taste only distinguished food from everything else. But Judaism disagreed, and it insisted the exact opposite. Judaism was suspicious of vision as deceptive. V'lo taturu acharei levavchem v'acharei einechem. Whereas Judaism has always placed eating in general and taste specifically at the center of its ritual performance, so that our theology and our virtues are imbibed as children, not only intellectually, but physically, so that we can taste our values on the tip of our tongue, and that remains with us as adults. So that if, famously, Proust describes eating the Madeleine and being transported all the way back to his childhood, everybody knows this from Proust, which he obviously stole from the Pixar movie Ratatouille, where the food critic eats the Ratatouille and is transported back to his home. We understand that for us, the physicality of eating actually allows for education in an emotionally profound way. And that this physical act of eating can be transformed to an act of worship. Thus, Rabbi Soloveitchik writes in his essay, Uvikashtem Misham, I'm citing my own English translation. He says, this act of eating, this animalistic function on which the life of man depends, was changed through Jewish law and transformed into religious worship and an act of great ethical value. It says in the Torah, and you shall eat before the Lord your God the tithes of your grain. A commandment such as this, he writes, is incomprehensible to Greek philosophy, for which an animal eats while man thinks. It is the intellect for the Greeks that draws close to the divine, not the stomach. Nevertheless, says the Torah, for the Torah, the halacha prefers eating before God over prayer. That's my favorite sentence ever. The halacha prefers eating before God over prayer. Eating sacrifices, eating the Paschal lamb, eating matzah, eating the offerings of joy, on the holidays, all these are biblical commandments of the Torah according to all opinions, while prayer is counted among the commandments only according to Maimonides. And that means that in order to understand the nature of Maror and Pesach and how they work together, to understand the theological significance of these foods, we have to understand food and we have to understand taste. And have to understand why for Judaism, these are not lowly aspects of the human experience, but teach us profound truths and remind us profound truths about politics and morality and theology and our history. And here, I'm greatly indebted to one of America's most celebrated food writers, Jennifer McClagan, who wrote a book called Bitter, A Taste of the World's Most Dangerous Flavor, with recipes. That's the title. Okay? And she has helped me to understand the mistake that we make in approaching these foods, especially Pesach and its joining with Maror. We tend to assume that the essential point in eating the Maror is to undergo an unpleasant experience and thereby endure in a physical way the bitterness of slavery. Now, the reason for this is understandable because as a child, we tend to learn to dislike bitter foods, and that's actually a survival instinct because many poisons are bitter. But the truth is, as McLagan notes, some of the most wonderful foods have bitterness. And as we mature, we realize that many bitter foods actually stimulate our nervous system in ways we enjoy. So, as McLagan puts it, bitterness is a double-edged sword. It signals toxic and dangerous, but it can also be pleasurable and beneficial. Without bitterness, we lose a way to balance sweetness, and by rejecting it, we limit our range of flavors. Food without bitterness, she writes, lacks depth and complexity. Let me illustrate this point by citing one of the most wonderful examples of food in the world, coffee. Everyone likes coffee. Okay, so there are a few people out there who don't like coffee, but those people are terrible people. Okay? All right? People say, I drink tea, I don't drink coffee. Go back to England, okay? I think we fought a whole war, I'm pretty sure, so we didn't have to drink tea. That was the whole point of it, okay? Okay? The entire art of roasting coffee, if you study it, is balancing its bitterness. Or as the food writer John McQuay tells us, in roasting, all must be managed to trigger a particular set of chemical reactions. If there's not enough bitterness, the coffee is lifeless. If it's too much, then it's undrinkable, like a day-old pot at a 7-Eleven. Now, we miss out on this because Americans like sweet foods, but most world cultures actually incorporate bitter, as does, as we shall see, the culinary customs of the Middle East. This is important because, as McLagan tells us, cooking is about balancing tastes, and bitter often plays a vital role in a dish's harmony. It is crucial to the composition of a meal or menu. Without a touch of bitterness, your cooking will be lacking a dimension. And it's with this in mind that we can better appreciate the centerpiece of the Seder as it was meant to be performed. Korban Pesach, the Paschal Lamb, reminding us of this moment when Israelites came together and ate as a family, along perhaps with their neighbors, as we'll see in a minute, but eating it together with maror, either wrapping it with maror and matzah, or eating it together as part of the meal. The problem is, what we often miss out on is that we don't understand what maror truly means. We tend to think, many of us, that to eat what is called maror in the Bible is to eat something terribly unpleasant. The reason why many of us think that is because many of us associate maror with freshly ground horseradish, with which to eat the required amount of a kezayit, an olive's bulk, is an act of suicide. So I'm just going to hit you with some courageous truth-telling. Horseradish is not maror. It's a perfect candidate for maror, for bitter herb, except for two problems. It's not bitter, and it's not an herb. Aside from that, it's a great bitter herb. Okay. The five species of maror are listed in the Mishnah. None of them are horseradish. And we also, horseradish was utilized by Eastern European Jews, including my ancestors, because I couldn't find anything else. And that's okay. But what we have to understand as well is that lettuce, which is one of the species of maror, was originally slightly bitter. As Ari Zivitovsky, author on all things biblical and culinary, puts it, heading the list of the rabbi's list of the five species of bitter herbs and presumably the preferred item is chazeret. The Talmud identifies this as chasa, the modern Hebrew word for lettuce, and there is little doubt that the Mishnaic chazeret is lettuce. Lettuce is a winter plant in Israel and thus was and is readily available in time for Pesach. Israel's wild lettuce neither looks nor tastes like the lettuce sold in American supermarkets. It consists of a central stalk with loose, prickly, dark green leaves. It continues to grow wild in Israel. The lettuce is bitter, especially as it ages, and when its stalk is cut, it oozes a considerable amount of white, bitter sap. Early cultivated lettuce had this same sap. The second herb listed as a candidate for bitter herbs is one we can find today with a taste of bitterness, and this is what the Mishnah calls ulshin, translated as by Rashi as indeve, which is universally understood to refer to endives, which is, of course, a wonderfully delicious herb, which is delicious in part because of its bitterness. It is, that is one of the species of bitter herbs, and that is probably the closest one we have today to what bitter herbs were meant to be originally. In understanding the potential for bitter greens to actually enhance the eating experience, and to enhance it both in the eating of it itself and in the balancing of other foods, this actually allows us to better understand not only the presence of Maror in the Seder, but its twin, the food with which it's paired, which is the centerpiece of the Seder, which is the Paschal lamb. Jennifer McLagan, in her book on bitterness, writes the following. In cooking school during a class on catering, we were advised to always start our dinner menu with an appetizer that was slightly sweet. Being sweet, she writes, it would suppress the guests' appetites. They would be satisfied with smaller portions for the rest of the meal, and we would be rewarded with bitter profits. But bitter, as we know, she writes, has the opposite effect. It stokes the appetite. And that is why, in a multi-course dinner, you should try something bitter between the courses, a salad of bitter leaves. Bitterness also enhances a dish. Understanding the role of bitter in balancing a recipe is an essential skill for a cook. Introducing a little bitterness is a good way to temper rich and fatty foods. Pairing these with a bitter vegetable will make them seem lighter and less rich. In return, the fat will take the edge off the bitter ingredient, making it seem less bitter. This is why, she writes, bitter greens make a good match with a fatty meat. End quote. And so, ladies and gentlemen, let us return now to the theology and the politics of the Paschal lamb. Can you think of any multi-course meal in our religion that encourages us to eat bitter leaves with a fatty meat? That, of course, is the Seder. That is what you are supposed to do. The main ingredient is lamb. It is the ultimate fatty meat, a young lamb between the age of 8 days and a year. It is the ultimate fulfillment of the classic line from My Big Fat Greek Wedding to someone who says he's a vegetarian: you don't eat no meat, no problem, I make lamb. Okay? And so you're pairing this lamb, the symbol of the beginning of our freedom, Vayihi b'chatzi halayla, v'Hashem yikach kol b'chor be'eretz Mitzrayim, the moment at midnight when God struck Egypt, which forced our freedom, while we were saved, while we were each in our homes eating together, that's paired with the bitter leaves, which does not detract from the experience, but rather enhances it, makes us hungrier, makes us enjoy it more, balances the taste. Which means that the maror was not biblically intended, and Ibn Ezra says something similar, that the maror was not biblically intended to be eaten at the meal in order to detract from the meal, but to balance it, deepen it, enhance it. The maror is not meant to be ingested to remember the slavery so that we can then celebrate our freedom. The maror is intended to be eaten while we eat the Pesach so that we remember the slavery while celebrating the first moment of our freedom and deepening thereby our appreciation of that freedom. Just as when you combine bitter greens with meat, rather than being overwhelmed by the bitterness, instead the experience of the meat course is rendered more profound, so too the lesson of the maror is that in the midst of celebrating our freedom, we remember all those who have had bitter experiences in the past, all the previous generations who have suffered and sacrificed so that we could be here. And we remember them, not in order to cause us pain and sorrow at the moment, but to enhance and lend a deeper dimension to the freedom that we are marking with the Paschal sacrifice. Remembering those who have suffered so that we might be here is not something we only do in mourning and sadness for what was lost. We remember them to lend a profundity, a sanctity, a sense of responsibility to our celebration of our freedom. How does this work? Let us take as an example a different case of the melding of food and faith, which is one of the best modern memoirs that I've read. This is a book called Miriam's Kitchen, which I highly recommend. And it's written by a woman named Elizabeth Ehrlich. She was a secular Jewish writer who marries a young Jewish man whose mother, this is her mother-in-law, Miriam, is a Holocaust survivor who lost most of her family in the Holocaust. She was once part of a vast family, most of whom were murdered. And Miriam now is an observant Jew, but she is also passionately committed to preserving and utilizing before every holiday the recipes that she has received from her family. And as Elizabeth Ehrlich becomes part of this family and learns Miriam's story, she feels an obligation to learn these recipes too. And then when she has a daughter, she feels the obligation to teach it to her daughter, Miriam's granddaughter. And as she does this in preparation for the holidays, she then feels an obligation to take on the observance of these holidays. And so it is three different books in one. It is a book about the Holocaust. It is a book about a return to Judaism. And it is a book about food. And so, as she writes, "What made me value my inheritance as a treasure, not as a burden? The luck that has placed me as an adult in range of Miriam's kitchen. My mother-in-law Miriam, born in a small village in Jewish Poland, survived the Holocaust. A keeper of rituals and recipes and of stories, she cooks to recreate a lost world, to prove that unimaginable loss is not the end of everything. She is motivated by duty to ancestors and descendants, by memory and obligation, and an impossible wish to make the world whole." And then, in a way that you would have expected to be odd rather than meaningful, the book oscillates back and forth between the monstrous and the mundane, from a tale of what Miriam has lost to the recipes and descriptions and the preparations for food that Miriam is making. But rather than actually a clash, the two themes meld together, rendering the entire experience much more profound. So I'll give you one paragraph. She's describing Miriam making cheese danishes for Shavuot, which she learned from her grandmother. Okay, so she writes, "The great-grandmother showed her five daughters how to do this, and they were to transmit the knowledge to daughters of their own. The four sons, who are the sons of this woman from whom the recipe originates, might have also brought home four wives eager to learn Poland's best cheese danishes recipes, wives who too would have passed the recipe along. By now," writes Ehrlich, "if the world were a just place, dozens of kitchens, genetically linked, should have been busy this pre-festival Friday, with rolling pins, graters, and spoons, turning out these very danishkas. Instead, it has come to this. Miriam is an only child who came out of the war with a mother, two aunts, and an uncle, showing me on behalf of a single granddaughter." And then she just goes on to write, "We make the filling. Miriam pushes the farmer cheese through a grater. She mixes the farmer cheese, half a beaten egg, vanilla sugar, sour cream, sugar, yellow raisins." Let's analyze this for a moment. Does this connection between terrible past and placid present ruin the experience of eating the danishes, celebrating the Shavuot? On the contrary, it endows the experience and Shavuot itself with a sense of sacred obligation, of continuity, of responsibility, and ultimately of victory over those who attempted to destroy us in the past. Or as we say in the Haggadah, "Bechol dor vador omdim aleinu lechaloteinu, v'hakadosh baruch hu matzileinu miyadam." Ehrlich herself imagines what continuing the cooking for a festive holiday, using the recipe that her murdered mother had, what it must mean to Miriam. She writes as follows. "I'm sure the flavor is altered when you have lived Miriam's life. Yet serious cooking is an essentially optimistic act. It reaches into the future, vanishes into memory, and creates the desire for another meal." So what you have here actually is religion coming together with food, the emotional aspect of food binding a family together. Here actually, what reveals itself is something profoundly at the heart of the Korban Pesach. When we think about it, the Paschal Lamb is a strange sort of sacrifice. On the one hand, it is the supreme symbol of Jewish covenantal identity. We know this because, aside from circumcision, it is the only obligation of which failure to perform it leads to the punishment of excision, of karet. So, Brit Milah, circumcision, and the Paschal Lamb, the blood of the Brit, and the blood of the Pesach are always joined together. So the Korban Pesach is the symbol of the formation of the nation of Israel. On the other hand, usually when we have a Korban, an offering that represents the entire nation, you have one animal personifying the entire people. So every day in the temple, Korban Tamid, one lamb in the morning, one lamb in the afternoon, and that lamb represents the entire Jewish people. On Yom Kippur, there is one goat on which is placed the sins of the entire Jewish people. Here, you have something different. The entire community is obligated to bring an offering, but many offerings are brought. Not one for the whole people, but also not one per individual. Rather, Korban Pesach is brought in what is called a chabura, a group. In fact, all the laws of Korban Pesach are set up to ensure that it needs to be brought as a group. Because what are the eating rules of the Paschal Lamb? It needs to be finished by when? When do you need to finish it at? Either midnight or dawn, okay? It can't be eaten raw, which means you have to spend some time cooking it. You can't break a bone in eating it, which means you have to eat it slowly and carefully. And you can't have any left over by the next morning, which means you have to finish the whole lamb. All this means is that you are given to remember the original Pesach, and these were the rules for the original Pesach. You are obligated to do this together with your family. And if your family is not large enough, then you have to bring your neighbor, as the Torah says, V'mimat habayit miseh, v'lakach hu u'shcheino ha'karov elav. If you don't have enough people to eat the whole lamb, you get your neighbor and you join together. This is the first law that is given to the people of Israel as a nation after the Jewish calendar. And what it tells us is something profound. It's something that Tocqueville discovered about America. What makes us strongest as a society? It's not the individual, but it's not the national government either. It's what's in between. It's what sustains us. Family, community, people coming together around shared endeavors, shared meals, helping each other, doing tasks together. That is what creates a society. This is something, as my friend Yuval Levin has noted, that both political parties have largely lost. So in 2012, the theme at the Republican convention was, in response to President Obama's line, "You did build that." Meaning Senator President Obama says, if you have a business, you didn't build that, right? So the theme of the convention the first day of the Republican convention was, "You did build that." And it was emphasizing every individual built his or her own business on their own. Okay, so it was all about just the individual. The Democratic convention was the exact opposite. It began with the very creepy line, government is the one thing we all have in common. Okay? And the DNC, as you recall, had an advertisement with an imaginary woman named Julia, for whom the administration's policies take care of her whole life. She doesn't have children who take care of her. She doesn't have family who takes care of her. Only the government takes care of her. Nobody else. And nobody, Republican or Democrat, is talking about what takes place in between. The extraordinary bond that happens when people come together. That's what's taking place at the Korban Pesach. And that's what's taking place in Miriam's kitchen. A woman joins a family. She knows nothing of these traditions. She engages in the shared endeavor between grandmother, daughter-in-law, and granddaughter. And in the process, a family is born, and a link in a nation is revitalized. And like the Korban Pesach, which is meant to be eaten with the bitter herbs, the memories of Miriam's bitter experiences only render the joy in the rekindling of these traditions all the more profound. They lend an obligation to the freedom that they now have. And that's what Ehrlich discovers in Miriam's kitchen about Judaism as well. As she writes, first learning recipes from her mother-in-law and then ultimately koshering her kitchen, keeping Shabbat, reflecting openly, honestly on her own imperfections, but noting that Miriam's own horrible experiences have lent a deeper dimension to her own experience of freedom. She writes as follows, and this is exactly what the blending of Maror and Pesach is meant to be. It is all well and good, she writes, to rely on other Jews to keep Judaism going, while she herself picks and chooses. But she writes, quote, without commitment, the sources will die. The forms we love to have the choice to return to will wither and disappear. Or worse yet, become hollow shells, cultural theme parks. Someone, many someones, have kept the forms vital and alive, have kept the choices available to me. It is my turn now. And so the memories of what Miriam has gone through, the admiration for how she has carried on her family's traditions, the feeling that there really are so many others who should be carrying on for the previous generation, that there should be so many celebrating Shavuot who are not, Pesach who are not, Sukkot who are not, that is what allowed her to understand her responsibility as a Jew living in the freedom of the United States of America. In this scenario, it is not the bitter memories that are experienced on their own. It is the bitter memories that lend profundity and joy to her own celebrations of these holidays. That is why Maror is blended with Pesach. Let me give you one other brief example, a non-culinary one. This is from Yehuda Avner, author of the magisterial memoir, The Prime Minister. It's about his front row seat to Jewish history in the 20th century. But one of my favorite stories from him was one that could have been witnessed by anybody. He said in a speech once that he was on the street in Yerushalayim and he saw a young chayal, a young Israeli soldier, going off to do army duty. And he was saying goodbye to his grandfather. The grandfather wanted to show his grandson what this army service meant to him. And so the grandfather rolled up his sleeve and showed his grandson, the Israeli soldier, the numbers tattooed on his arm. In response, the grandchild said nothing, but he reached into his shirt and he took out his own metal Israeli army tags and showed his grandfather his own Israeli army numbers. It's a simple moment, but so profound in describing how the past lends profundity to our present, obligation to our independence. And so the political message of the Paschal Lamb is actually not merely the message of Pesach, but the message of Pesach together with Maror. Often, people living in one generation may not want to remember the unpleasant memories of the past. They may not want to think about those who suffered and those who died, but they are obligated to do so. Because otherwise, if they lose the connection to that past, then their present is rendered meaningless. And indeed, they are called by the past, obligated by it. It is, in a certain sense, similar to what Lincoln said at Gettysburg. It is for us, the living, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus so far nobly advanced. It is rather for us here to be dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain. In this, returning to the text of the Haggadah, is how we are meant to understand the ordering of the foods of the Seder. Pesach, Matzah, Maror. One would have thought that we would have ordered these differently. Indeed, that we would have eaten Maror first, remembering in sadness the slavery. But no, we discuss the Maror only after we have already spoken about Pesach and Matzah. And interestingly, according in the Maimonides version of the Haggadah, when you actually have the Paschal Lamb, he mixes around the order a little bit, but still the Maror is not first. It's Pesach, Maror, Matzah. Because the Maror, biblically, when you have Pesach, goes together with it. But not does not precede it. It comes still after it. Because the Maror is not eaten in sadness. The memories that it evokes are sad. But we have other days to be sad. You're not allowed to be sad on Pesach. We have Tisha B'Av for that. Pesach is a happy day. And the Maror is ingested in happiness. Only after we have marked the significance of Pesach and Matzah, we eat the Maror to lend a deeper dimension to our freedom. It was Rabbi Norman Lamb who once reflected how odd it is that we seem excited by the opportunity to eat Maror on Pesach. We say a blessing on it. Blessed are you, God, who has obligated us to eat this bitter herb. And so he says the following homiletical idea. It's a little too kind about charoset, which FYI is not delicious and is horrible. But nevertheless, I think people only like charoset because we've become accustomed to eating sweet foods and North America. Some people even put sugar on their matzah brei, which I can assure you is an offense against both God and man. But Rabbi Lamb says the following about dipping maror into charoset. He writes, but the message of maror is more than just the awareness of the bitter sweet taste. You know, he begins by saying, what does it mean to say a blessing in maror? Thank you, God, for this morsel of misery. What does he mean? So he says as follows. Rabbi Lamb likes alliteration. So he writes, but the message of maror is more than just the awareness of the bitter sweet taste of life. More than just the idea that every black cloud has a silver lining. What Maror wants to tell us is that misery is not meaningless, that pain is not pointless punishment, that human anguish has larger dimensions, and that the bitter leads to the sweet. In fact, without the foretaste of Maror, Charoset loses its value. There can be no sweet without bitter, no light without darkness before it, no joy without prior sadness. A people that dips Maror into Charoset and says a blessing over it is defeated neither by fate nor by foe. A folk that can find the mellow in a morsel of misery can drive away the darkness with its own light, the outer sorrow with the inner joy. And so even though we don't have the Pesach today, though we do, as we'll discuss next week, pray at the end of Magid for its return. Nevertheless, the politics of the Passover lamb, its approach to history, is an extraordinary message for us. And that is that the Pesach must be paired with Maror, thereby lend a deeper dimension to all that Pesach embodies. And all that matzah embodies. After we realize that we have Pesach and we have matzah, that we have freedom, we have to remember the Maror to lend an obligation to that freedom. And the striking thing is that today, many American Jews call this holiday Pesach or Passover without thinking about what the Paschal Lamb really was, and certainly not longing for its return, and certainly not pondering its message about how the sacrifice of the past obligate our continuity in the present. And yet it is American Jewry more than anyone else who needs this message. Because more than anyone else, we have been given freedom unlike any other diaspora community. And yet, so often American Jewry has used this freedom to abandon the past, to forget the previous memories, to respond to the bitter memories by essentially saying, as does Tevye, God, I realize that we are the chosen people, but maybe you could choose someone else for a change. But if we truly took the message of Maror and Pesach together, we would understand the obligation that it imposes upon us as American Jews. I mentioned to you that I enjoy researching American Passover Seders in history. And I came upon this wonderful menu from a U.S. Army Seder in Italy, April 1945. It's organized by a chaplain. Okay, so as you see, it's like really like the two luchot, and these are Seder organized by the Jewish Welfare Board. And I close by describing this to you. On the one side, it has a menu. It starts with hors d'oeuvres, parsley and fennel and salt dipped in salt water, bitter herbs dipped in charoset, hard-boiled eggs in salt water, appetizer, gefilte fish a la Jewish Welfare Board, soup, knedlach or borscht a la Sergeant Weinstein, entree, fresh kosher lamb army style, which I take to mean not fresh, okay? Potatoes, non-dehydrated, because that was a huge thing, to have non-dehydrated potatoes, cauliflower, and Hamisha matzah fry, okay? Then it says dessert, fruit cup, afikoman, okay? Now, on the other side, it has the order of the service. So it starts with kiddush, dipped vegetable, etc., etc. Number six is the three essential symbols. That's Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. Number seven is Psalms of Praise. That's Hallel. Number eight is the blessing of the matzah. Number nine, the blessing of the bitter herb. And what comes right after that is number 10, which is Bitei Avon, eat happily, glad that you are free. Number 11, grace after the meal. Number 12, the cup of Elijah. 13, closing psalms and hymns. Number 14, God bless America. Number 15, Hatikva, 1945. Okay, and this is exactly what we're describing. These soldiers in 1945 at the end of the war had seen so much horror. They had seen their comrades die. They had lost many dear friends. And they knew that all the horror they had seen didn't compare to the horror that was going on in the countries that they were fighting in. At this moment, and those are horrible and bitter experiences, at this moment, this does not take away from the joy, but it deepens their sense of joy and deepens their sense of obligation and of gratitude and of working for the Jewish people toward the future. An obvious connection between number 9, the blessing of the bitter herb, and number 10, Bitei Avon, eat happily, glad that you are free. And a connection from these two to God Bless America and to Hatikva. And so that ultimately is the message of the Paschal Lamb and of the bitter herb, that a nation is formed by its families and that it is in the links formed by the families that we learn that the bitter memories that our families bear from the past obligate us in the freedom of the present. And understood this way, the Maror is more of a profoundly wonderful eating experience than any sweet food ever could be. Thank you very much.